to welcome you all to this important meeting. I would request colleagues and also attendants to have their phones switched off. I suppose there will be a recording of proceedings, and if your cell phone is on, even if it is on silent, it might affect the recording of the proceedings. I'll then start with our honorable members to introduce themselves, and thereafter officials from the department and other attendants from Parliament. Yes?
Sorry, Chairperson, it seems the one projector is not working. Is that the case? Because then I would like to perhaps move around to be able to observe.
I should assume that it is not working. Whilst relevant officials will do it, let's just sit according to how we think we need to. Yeah, can we proceed and introduce ourselves?
My name is Crosby Money. I'm a member of the committee and listener to the presentation.
I'm Wendy Nelson and also a member of the portfolio.
I'm Janita Klopas-Lovins, also a member.
And the person who wants to know everything that's going on and wants to see is Andrikus van der Westhuys, and a member of the committee.
I'm from Port Harcourt. A member of this committee coming from the Kingdom of KwaZulu-Natal. Thank you.
Ivan Boso, I'm from the Department of Education and Training, and I also just want to send the apologies of the Director General who is not able to attend this meeting today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, I'm Alan Small, I'm a senior statewide advisor.
Good afternoon, Advocate Gordon, parliamentary legal advisor.
Sorry, Chair, Matthew Parks from COSATU.
I'm Fakile Mukwena from Parliament Communications Service.
Hi, Chair. Khalid Said, Ethical Solutions.
Good afternoon. My name is Mariana Erasmus. I'm from the Department of Higher Education and Training, Legal and Legislative Services.
My name is Luke Simpson. I'm from the PMG.
Okay. Thank you. I know that other officials prefer not to introduce themselves. But we know them. I'm going to take this opportunity and allow the official from the department to lead the presentation of the bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there are copies also available, hard copies for the members. There's two of the three bills that's on the parliamentary program that has been tabled and which is the subject of the discussion today. The Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill, the Further Education and Training Colleges Amendment Bill, this bill was originally referred to as the Higher Education and Training Laws Amendment Bill, but because there were only amendments to the Further Education and Training Act, the Colleges Act, it name therefore was changed because there was no need to refer to him as an omnibus bill. Chair, the two bills that have been tabled, and then the Skills Development Amendment Bill will be tabled soon, and which will also be, or which bill is also part of the parliamentary program. the Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill, that's Section 75 of the Constitution, procedure that must be followed, because these are legislation which fall within the exclusive national competency. This bill seeks to amend two pieces of legislation, the Higher Education Act of 1997 and the National Student Financial Aid Schemes Act of 2000. The Higher Education Act is amended to provide for the conduct of members of council and staff when engaging with business with the public higher education institution, and also to adjust the period in which the independent assessor must finalize investigation. The National Student Financial Aid Scheme Act is amended to empower the minister to intervene by way of an administrator in the case of poor or non-performance or maladministration by the board, and to provide for ministerial power of intervention to remove the board, as well as the procedures for such removal. It further repeals the provision which places an obligation on the employer of the borrower, that the student is getting is now in the employ of that employer, to make deductions from his salary. The Higher Education Laws Amendment Act, the first piece of legislation that we deal with is the Higher Education Act and the amendments thereto. That's contained in clauses 1, 2, and 3 of that bill. Clause 1 is an amendment to Section 27 of the Principal Act, and Clause 2 is a similar amendment in nature, but it deals with an amendment to Section 34 of that Act. The intention behind this amendment is to deal with the conduct of the council members and also staff when it comes to engaging with business and other activities for financial gain, and where they, as decision makers or influential parties within the institution, and how they must then deal with it. So these are legislation which is introducing an obligation in terms of clause 1 on the council members to declare any business, commercial or financial activities for gain that may arise to a possible conflict of interest with the public institution, and it further to place an obligation on a member not to have a conflict of interest, and to inform the chairperson in writing beforehand as soon as possible to address that issue and to make sure that such person is not part of the decision making process. And then it also ensure that the members and the members of staff do not act in self-interest, but perform the functions of the institution to the best interest of that higher education, that university or that they serve. Chair, it is also the intention behind this, these two amendments are to curb corruption and to make sure that there is no abuse of money where people are taking decisions which can have a personal financial gain to them. Clause 3 of the bill is to deal with a different aspect. It is the period for which an independent assessor is by law allowed to perform the function and to provide the report. The intention has always been to make it a very it's a swift interaction, identify the problem, provide the solution, and get out of the institution. And the time frame that is currently in the legislation is 30 days. Now, Chair, it has been a problem to manage it within that time frame, and very few of the independent assessors could manage it within that time frame. The reason? It is an obligation on the independent assessor to consult with all the different role players. You also find that sometimes the time frame within which this investigation must be conducted is also linked to a period where the university might not be functional because it is a holiday, student holidays, or the end of the year where there's a festive season, and that creates a difficulty to comply with that 30-day time frame. And it is a very important time frame because it is a time frame which must be complied with, the 30 days, as it is currently, and by failing to do that, it creates a non-compliance. Here, the intention of this amendment is not to make it indefinite, but to provide a maximum time of 90 days to deal with it, and it will allow the independent assessor to consult with the different role players, the student bodies, the employee organizations, the management, the broader student community, and to make sure that there is a feasible solution that is presented to the minister on the way forward. Chair, 4-7 is dealing with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme Act, and these clauses are introducing, well, all of them are new clauses introducing to the Act, and it is dealing with the first issue is dealing with a new Section 4A, which is providing the minister to intervene. The intervention that is now possible if the board has experienced financial difficulties, has been mismanaging funds, is unable to perform its functions effectively, or act obstructively and not in compliance with the law or directives given by the minister. The minister may give then direction to the board to take action and to identify, and these directions will identify the nature of the deficiencies and the steps that must be taken to remedy the situation within the set period. The clause further provides the minister to follow a process in compliance with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act by providing a notice of intention and to give directives to intention of the directors he is going to give, and to allow the board an opportunity to make representations. If the board fails to comply with the directives given by the minister may appoint an administrator to take over these functions, and the intention of this is to provide a capacity building and to deal with corrective measures, and to provide a situation that when the administrator is actually his or her term comes to an end, that the board will be in a better position to deal with it and to provide a continuity in order to run the business of this fund more effectively. Here it is also important that the cost of this appointment will come from the administrative costs or budget of the NSFAS. Clause 5 introduces once again a new clause or new section 7A which empowers the minister to dissolve the NSFAS board if the conduct of the board necessitates this action and the solution of the board is in the best interest of higher education and the NSFAS. If more than 75% of the members of the board has resigned, then the board obviously becomes dysfunctional, chair. And if there's less than 75% that resigned, that the administrator who's been appointed make a formal recommendation that it would be in the best interest that the new board be appointed in order to provide stability and to provide compliance with the legislation. If the board has been dissolved and there's no administrator appointed at that point in time, then an administrator must be appointed in order to provide that, carry that transitional period in order to appoint a new board. And lastly, the bill provides that the minister must comply with the due process which is guided by the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Clause 6 is once again providing three new sections to the Act, and it's dealing with the appointment of the administrator. The administrator will be appointed if an audit shows that there is financial or other maladministration of a serious nature, which undermines the effective functioning of the NSFAS, and the administrator will then be appointed for a maximum of 2 years, and the term may be extended once for a 6-month period. The provisions as proposed in the bill also compels the minister to appoint a person or persons that have suitable knowledge and experience to assist this administrator in the performance of the functions. And lastly, it also provides for remuneration and allowances for the administrator and other persons appointed to him or her. These are in line with the Public Finance Management Act and their regulations, which provide for this type of intervention, and it is in accordance with those provisions. Then the last clause, which is clause 7, this introduced a repeal of section 23 of the National Student Financial Aid Act, and this section is currently providing an obligation on the employer to deduct money from the employee, the student, or the borrower who received the loan through the NSFAS, and in the event that the employer fails to comply with that provision, such conduct will be an offence, and the employer can be ordered to make deductions or payment. This obligation that's been placed on the employer is considered to be an infringement on the right of the employer, and then the repeal of the section. There's been a legal opinion from a very prominent advocate which was obtained by the NSFAS about this provision, and that senior advocate is of the opinion that it is unconstitutional to enforce this deduction without an intervention of court, and over and above the obligation and criminalization of an employer who is not even a party to the contract. And for that reason, Chair, it is the request has been that there is a deletion of this provision, and it is therefore repealed through this amendment. Here, the next bill that's also introduced is the Further Education and Training Colleges Bill. Chair, this bill is amending, it is focusing on basically two prominent lines of amendment. The first line is to deal with all the references that's currently in this bill that refers to provincial authorities and to amend it to refer to national authorities. The reason for that is, first of all, that before I get to the reason, maybe I can just also refer to the other prominent line that is also covered by the bill, and that is the issue of the appointment of staff in the bill. Currently, all the staff are in the employ of the college, except for the principal and the deputy principals. They are public servants. All the other staff are within the employ of the college and managed through the council of the institution. And, Chair, the bill seeks to revert back to the position that existed prior to 2006, when this Colleges Act the Unity Colleges Act came into existence. Chair, clauses 1 to 10, 14 to 33 is dealing with this change or amendment that is providing a shift from the functionaries from provincial to national. Here, this is an issue which originated in 2009 when the Department of Basic Education and Higher Education established from the old Minister of Education, and the Minister's responsibility is to focus on education outside school education, adult education in other words. And the focus of the Minister of Basic Education and the nine provinces were on school education, which is a massive system and which got a lot of attention that is going into the size of that system. The Council of Education Ministers agreed that the responsibilities must move to national. EDCOM, the Head of Education Departments, supported that recommendation of the CEM, and the actual introduction of the Distribution of Revenue Act of 2010-11 as well as 2011-12 already provided that a grant has been identified on the national budget to deal with the funding of the colleges in the step of moving the responsibility away from the provinces and to free them, in a manner of speak, to focus on schools rather than on the institution, the FET colleges as such. Over and above that, there's also a constitutional amendment that's been introduced. It's the 19th Amendment Bill to the Constitution, which also give effect to this approach, where the exclusive national competency for adult education will then be with the National Minister, where the Skills Development Act, the Higher Education Act, the NSFAS Act, National Qualifications Framework Act, all those legislation are already within the the exclusive domain of the national government, and therefore the report has followed through with the further education and training colleges. Chair, the important thing is that it is a process which is also linked to the very last clause, where the enactment of those provisions will be on a different date for each of the clauses in order to allow the different state of readiness also to be in place and to ensure that the constitutional amendments and all the others that are supporting this are actually in place when this provision of coming into force through a government notice. Here, if we move on to clauses 11, 12, 13 and the transitional arrangement, which is in clause 34, Chair, this amendment seeks to deal with the employment status and it is trying to revert back to what was in the old FET, Further Education and Training Act of 1998. In that act, those posts that were fully funded by the state were not only created as posts on the establishment of a provincial department, but also the employment of the employer of those employees who were denied provincial departments and they were public servants. So in terms of the proposal which came as a result of the summit, of the Further Education and Training Colleges summit, and also the support that the trade unions gave to that proposal, the minister then tried to revert back as far as possible. Chair, the intention is to once again not create a financial burden which is not budgeted for, and the intention of this amendment is to identify posts which are currently falling within the norms and standards within the subsidy paid to the colleges, and that those posts that can be identified that being funded through the state subsidy will then be converted and will be transferred to become public service posts and to deal with it in terms of the Public Service Act. So it must be noted that originally in 1998 up until 2006 the lecturers, not the support staff but the lecturers, were employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act, but in 2006 they were taken out of that scope of the act, and that act were only then providing employment and conditions of employment to educators in school. The result of that is that act has also been transferred to the Minister of Basic Education and not to the Minister of Higher Education when it comes to college lecturers. And with the intention to provide a statutory amendment which transfer the staff that's currently in the employ, the lecturing staff that's currently in the employ of the college to back to the state, means that it will then be dealt with in terms of the Public Service Act, which is also the act that has always been the employment legislation for any public servant employed in any department, except for the three exceptions, and that is to Defence Force, to the National Intelligence, and to the the educators that has been employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act. So, Chair, this amendment could not be covered by any of those three amendments, and therefore not only the lecturing staff, but also the support staff, which were prior to 2006 being public servants in terms of the Public Service Act, will revert back to that position if they are a fully funded post within the norms. So, Chair, the ECAS, we've tried to unscramble it to as far as possible, but unfortunately you can't revert exactly to the same position that existed when the amendment or the new act, the FET Colleges Act, came into existence in 2006. So the impact of this is that Clause 11 repeals Section 19 of the Principal Act because it becomes redundant through the enactment of Clause 12, which is now dealing with the employment issue of your staff, which is in addition to the public service staff appointed in terms of the Public Service Act, which both set of staff possibilities of post on the establishment is provided for in the new Section 20, which is an amendment introduced through Clause 12. It also provides that when the college creates additional posts in order to supplement the post that is provided by the state, those posts provided by the state will then be remunerated on exactly the same level than the state employees. And furthermore, Chair, also there must be sufficient funds on the budget of the college before they establish those posts in order to ensure that they don't run into financial difficulties. Chair, Clause 13 amends Section 21 of the Principal Act by substituting the word lecturers and support staff and only refer to staff as the differentiation between your lecturing staff employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act and the support staff which were originally coming from the Public Service Act, and when it moved into the amendment or the new Act in 2006, that differentiation between staff were then carried through in the legislation. With the new approach where you get your public service staff and also additional staff employed by the college, the differentiation between lecturer staff and support staff is not the focus. The focus is on where the employment originates from. Is it from the state or is it from the college? And that is the new focus in this bill. Chair, and then lastly, Clause 36, it deals with the transition arrangement to first of all provide the process of identification of the post, ensure that it complies with the labor laws, Section 197 and 197A of the Labor Relations Act, and to ensure that the rights of the employees are not prejudiced during that process, to ensure that your employees will have the benefit of agreements to be reached between the old and the new employer, and to make sure that there is the flexibility that you find within the current arrangement as contained in those sections of the Labor Relations Act. Thank you. That is the extent of the amendments.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. May I allow members an opportunity to engage in the presentation? There could be questions of clarity that might have arisen out of the presentation.
any relevant commentary that you wish to make to the department in respect of the briefing on the two bills. I can take hands now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm particularly concerned about the position of the FET College staff, so if I may jump straight to that act, that amendment act, or would you first like us to finish the Higher Education Laws Amendment Act? Can we intermingle the two? Must we concentrate on the one first?
We should deal with one bill and then go to the other later. You can continue.
Can I continue then with the FET Colleges Act?
Yes.
If possible. Chairperson, what concerns me with this act is that we are running in full circles here. First, the old technical colleges at one stage were a national competency. It was then deemed to be to the advantage of the sector to make that a provincial competency. Now we're going back to a national competency. At one stage it was deemed best for that staff to be government employees. As recently as less than 5 years ago, government came up, the officials came with the legislation in which they wanted all staff to be transferred to that of the college councils, with the exception of senior management. Now, less than 5 years later, they come to us and they say, no. It would be better if those people are government employees again. Now, Chairperson, immediately that must raise some questions. What has changed in 5 years, except for the fact that the ministry has been split into higher education and training and basic education? So I want to hear today not only the fact that the unions have supported this, etc. I want to hear how are we going to spend tax money better by transferring these people from the payroll of the colleges to that of government again. That is my first request. The second one is, I've just heard that there, if I heard correctly, that there will be no distinction between educators and support staff anymore in terms of our FET colleges. My first question is, educators at our FET colleges have got a particular role that differ from that of, for example, support staff. We want our educators often to offer tuition after normal office hours. We want the public to have access to colleges for adult training after hours. We want people to be trained on Saturdays and so on. And in the past, what I've known is that the staff, the support staff, were never entitled to overtime. They were never entitled to days off for working on Sundays, etc. Now, we know that students arrive on Sundays to start a new program on a Monday morning, etc. What are the provisions to build in that sort of flexibility for that staff? Will that staff be entitled to those benefits of overtime, for example? Yes or no? Also, we are sitting with hostel staff that for the last 20 odd years have been in the employment of the college councils. Are they also now going to be transferred? If I read it correctly, the answer is yes. My question is, how are you going to accommodate these people? Because the devil will be in the detail. The reason, to my mind, why the previous changes did not succeed was because it was managed badly. The idea wasn't bad. Minister Pandor eloquently argued for those changes 5 years ago, but the implementation of that is where it fell flat. And the colleges were hurt badly, and I am seriously concerned that more damage will be done if this situation is not managed better. Then also I have a question regarding the senior management staff. In some provinces,
the senior management staff, you've referred to the CEOs and the deputy CEOs, have been appointed on fixed term contracts. In other provinces, they've been appointed permanently. I want to know, before I can apply my mind, whether this proposed amendment is good or not. How will those people be treated? Will they be treated in terms of their existing terms of employment, or will they all become be treated the same and all become permanent staff? And then I also want to know whether there will be flexibility in terms of the organograms of the colleges, because colleges differ vastly. We've got some colleges that cover large distances, and we've got colleges in metros where it's less than 20 minutes drive between the different campuses, etc. Obviously, the demands in terms of how the organizational structure of those that college will look will be different. My fear is if we're going to rely on an organogram and only from own generated funds will colleges be allowed to deviate from that, that again, especially our rural colleges will be jeopardized, that they will be in a position which will not allow for them to really cover all the posts, to fill all the posts, to create all the posts that they require. So, Chair, if I could start off with those questions concerning the staff and their position, I would appreciate a response to that. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Let's do that.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the first issue that's been raised is that of colleges being national, putting the national competency of youth to provincial, and then now in the process of, or this is a proposal, is to move it back. Chair, in 1994, with the new dispensation, the technical colleges act were assigned to all 9 provinces. It never became an exclusive national competence. It was a function which was dealt with by the provincial government as part of the transfer of the legislation. A small portion of the Technical Colleges Act, which deals with policy making, were kept at the national level. And that was done in terms of, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was done in terms of Proclamation 106 of 1994. It is the first time that colleges will now become national competency if this amendment bill is approved and obviously supported by the constitutional amendment that is currently also in the government. So the other part of the question, which deals with the employment of the staff, and that it there's been a circle. That is true. The staff, some of the staff, were employed by the state, and the intention is to bring it back. In 2006, the unions were vehemently against this amendment. They did not support it, and it was a position which Mr. Bundle justified on the basis of the new landscape for colleges, the new qualification to it, and the whole intention to deliver EPP qualifications within a landscape which is more flexible. So it did not work like that. The colleges were not in a position to deal with all the demands of the employer. fact, even today, many of the previous public servants are still on the personal system of the various departments. The colleges couldn't take it over, couldn't deal with those systems, which is critical to the employees. And it is that reason which caused a rethinking of it in order to ensure that there is no consequence. The issue of the public servants and the flexibility within the Act, and first of all, it is important that one must start off with the issue of the lecturers versus the support staff. The Act or the amendment provides the authority as to who would be the employer. It does not provide the details as to what type of categories of employees and differentiations you would find within a normal employment environment. The reason why you found a reference to support staff and lecturers in previous legislation was because the lecturers were appointed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act, an act which provided for the employment, which differs from the Public Service Act. That differentiation is not there anymore. And the legislation that you would find that is now the driving force, the Public Service Act, is not repeated in this amendment. It is not necessary to repeat it. And all the flexibility as to is it a permanent appointment, a temporary appointment, a contractual appointment, the different possibilities on the organizational structure within your department, with which will provide for the post on the different colleges, will be based on the flexibility in the public service. The need of rural versus urban, the need of additional posts in order to deal with those different needs are all part of the Public Service Act and provided for within the structure that is currently in existence, and therefore it is not repeated in this piece of legislation. But yet it's all there. It is provided for. And then the post that remains with the college are those that is within their budget, which they've got money for, and which are to deal with specific flexibility that's needed within that specific college to deal with the different demands within the funding. And you would find that in rural colleges, power station open up in Ellis Ross. There is a demand for training. Money is made available to that college, and programs and additional employment opportunities can be created through that existence of business in that area, which is unique to that specific one. That flexibility is still provided for. And that is not taken away. It is a position that also existed pre-2006. The legislation does not refer to college staff and support staff, but the employer must then provide within the normal labor law to deal with it and to provide for the different categories and to differentiate when it comes to the appointment of additional lecturers, that it must comply with the same employment conditions of service that is applicable to another lecturer. When it comes to support staff, it is also doing the same work for the same salary, and therefore they must know they must pay the same money to their employees. So this proposal links the remuneration and allows that flexibility when there is additional money coming into the institution to deal with the additional need, additional flexibility which can be dealt with
within that institution itself. Just the aspect of hostel staff, that is a staff that will once again be determined according to the need. If there is a need for it on the organigram, and if there was a fully funded post through the subsidy, that post will be part of the organizational structure of the department. If it is not, it will be covered by the payment of that salary through additional posts created by the college in terms of them as employer and the conditions of service, which will be equal to that of a public servant. So, Chair, it is catered for. The Act cannot deal with all that detail, but it provides the authority to the different layers and the different entities in order to perform those statistics. Then the last issue I think was that it might be very damaging if it is not properly managed. And Chair, it was one of the important aspects of this legislation is to provide for different dates, for different sections to come into operation, to ensure that when the responsor, when the change becomes effective, that the authority who takes that responsibility are in a position to deal with it and deal with it effectively and not causing any breakdown in the service. So, Chair, the intention is to ensure that the status quo will continue up until a stage where there is effective delivery at the national, where national has got an organic structure, organizational structure, which incorporated all these different posts, where the employment are captured within the systems and moved over in a manner which is obviously under the oversight of this committee in Parliament as it is part of the legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to state it categorically that I believe that there was a time pre-1994, earlier than that, when the technical colleges were a national competency, but for that I will go back to the relevant legislation of the time. But I think, with all due respect, sir, your memory doesn't go back long enough. Secondly, sir, how can you have two employees who you promised the same conditions of service? The one is allowed to belong to the government employees pension fund. The other one is, by the rules of that fund, excluded from that. The one is allowed to belong to a certain medical aid scheme, GEMS, and the other one is excluded from that. And then you want to say to the two employees, your conditions of service are exactly the same. What has happened, sir, is that two employees have been working alongside each other. The one has been in the employment of the state, of the government, and the other one is in the employment of the college council. The one has enjoyed all the benefits of the government service, and the others have been denied those benefits. The one disciplinary process is dealt with through the college council and their own disciplinary code, and the other one is determined through that of the public service. Also, sir, how can we trust this system and these changes and the fact that this will be implemented in an acceptable way if the FET colleges, whose financial year starts in January of every year, have only learned in May of this year what funding they are going to receive this year? Now, this is just one example of the way in which the FET colleges have been managed over the last few years, sir. And my concern is
they've been given a Hobson's choice. The trade unions, yes, they say, please go back to the old system that we had, because the new system didn't work. But the new system didn't work because the rules of the game were not good. The new system didn't work because the support that the colleges were entitled to. Basic things such as, how much money will we have next year to pay our employees? They've only learned of that more than 4 months into that financial year. And sir, in a way, we've squandered our FET colleges. We've lost the competencies and the abilities that we have had in those colleges, and we can see that in the results of the college examinations. So please, I want to ask of the official, please tell me, how can you promise people the same conditions of service when they're not allowed to belong to the same funds, be it medical, pension, etc.? And in the past, there's been an interpretation that conditions of service, as stated in the previous act, only refer to your salary. And I want to know if there is a new understanding that conditions of service also include your fringe benefits. Thank you.
I naturally permit freedom of speech and deliberation, but I think colleagues must realize that we're dealing with tabling of these bills before Parliament, and we're going to have ample opportunity during consultations to have very intensive and extensive engagement with the content of the two bills. But let me take any further questions or inputs, and I think afterwards we'll then proceed to the second bill.
I was tempted to question, but I have been corrected through the response that the presenter has come up with. I was tempted because looking from the presentation on page 13, it was as if the amendment will not, if you look at it, it provides the remuneration of college staff to be less than the remuneration of the state employees. So I was going to question the exploitation part of it, but I think there was a mistake that was committed, so no, it has been answered. The rest will continue.
Yes. Chair, I just want to be clear on the repeal of Section 19 that deals with deductions. I just want to find out as to what recourse is NSFAS having if then that part is repealed, that is, it is taken out.
No, we're just about to get there. You are right, we're just about to get there. Honorable Nelson? Then let's take it that we, in terms of the clarity that we sought on the first bill, where we are clear. There's just one thing which I just wanted to check. I'm noticing that the two bills anticipate the 18th Amendment bill of the Constitution. I think in terms of that bill, the Department of Education will be abolished, because now we've got the Department of Basic Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training. We've got new two different departments. And now I've seen three pieces of legislation that continue to refer to the Minister of Education and to the Department of Education. And that would be the Further Education and Training Colleges Act. That would be the General and Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act of 2001, including the Higher Education Act. I should think maybe those are also some aspects that will have to be corrected in line with the constitutional amendment bill that is before Parliament at this stage. I may not need any answers to that. I just wanted to highlight that I don't think in the amendment of the Higher Education Act we may need to look at such aspects also in the further education and training legislation. We should also make those corrections so that we, yes.
Chair, I think it is important that one must just identify the fact that the Minister of Education and the creation of two new portfolios, that was done in 2009 through the presidential minute, and the legislative functions that were transferred in terms of Section 97 of the Constitution to the respective ministers, deriving from mainly the old Minister of Education, but in the case of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, also from the Minister of Labour, were done through two sets of proclamations. Proclamation 44 of 2008, 4 July of 2009, transferred the legislation that were under the Minister of Education to the two respective ministers, and it is then under the authority of Section 97 of the Constitution. Then proclamation number 56 of 4th of September 2009 then transferred provisions of the Skills Development Act as well as the Skills Development Levies Act from the Minister of Labour to the Minister of Higher Education and Training. The constitutional amendment to Schedule 4 is only affecting the legislation which is currently within the concurrent function of the Minister of with the national and provincial government, and the skills legislation has never been a Section 75 Act, a 76 Act. It's always been Section 75. The Higher Education Act, the universities, has always been excluded from the schedule. They've also been, in the opinion of the State Law Advisor, a Section 75 Act, and it is the FET Colleges Act which is the only one that is affected by the 19th Amendment Act. And Chair, we've also got a legal opinion from the State Law Advisors, and they've used the example of the social development legislation, the pensions, where legislation, even if the constitution is not amended, the legislation can move the responsibility from provincial to national, because of the nature of concurrent means that the national legislation can provide legislation without providing the a responsibility to provincial authorities. In this case, it is not the intention to follow that approach, but to deal with it in terms of the formal amendment to the Constitution to take that uncertainty out of play. But that affects the Colleges Act only. It's not affecting the other legislation which is already within the exclusive of national competency.
Thank you.
salaries of employees that are indebted to NSFOS. Then you'll come, you can post your question later after you have answered.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the normal approach of non-compliance to a loan is through the agreement within which the borrower and the fund providing the the funding that regulates how you deal with non-compliance. It is exceptional that you introduce the employer who is not a party to that contract. You have a statutory obligation and become even criminally liable for not complying to an agreement which he or she was not even a party to. And that is the difficulty we've got with the current legislation. So, Chair, the normal approach of dealing with non-compliance would be to deal with it within the legal prescripts, which provides for the non-complier to place the person on terms. The lawyers call it immora. You must deal with it and identify that you owe money, given a proper opportunity to rectify your breach of the agreement, whereafter a process in court will be determined the final outcome. So, Chair, that would be the remedy that would be available to the fund. Chair, I just need to mention that even though this is a provision that's been on the statute books from 2001 when the Act came into effect, 2001-2002, but it was never enforced by the NSFOS because of the difficulty, and not a single employer were ever charged for criminal offence because of the legal opinion they obtained from this legal. Although it's on the statute book, it's not putting them in a weakened position if it is repealed.
We'll have time to look at those and all manner of legal advice. Basically, this action has not been impugned by a court of law. It is merely a view of the department as a consequence of a legal advice. We will deal with that at the right time as a committee to check at all those aspects from our own view whether we find it illegal. I do know that there is some aspect of the tax law that entitles the tax person or tax man to take from the salary and so on, and it indemnifies the employer, for instance, from any action by the employee, all those things. So they are almost similar legislation, but I think we'll have time to deal with that, we as Parliament, to express our view whether we think it is unconstitutional and so on. I don't think it is the appropriate time we've had. There's no any judgment as yet. Now we will be able to express our thought on that as well. Dr. Atlos.
I was going to ask a question specifically on the rights of the employer. I wanted to know exactly what rights are you referring to. You refer to the Constitution, you refer to the opinion of the senior advocate. My further question was, what effect is it going to have on the fund as a whole, and what other measures are they can be taken then to force borrowers to pay to meet their liabilities, and are we working here towards eventually offering free undergraduate tertiary education to our students? But I accept your response. Another question was on NSFOS, and on page 6, the cost associated with the appointment of the administrator. What kind of money are we talking about? And is this the only account from which we can pay the administrator? Thank you.
Any further questions? So that you could just eclipse this portion. If there are any further questions, and if members don't have questions, then we can gravitate towards the closure of the meeting. Yes.
Thank you. Chairperson, may I just ask the official, by whom is the board of NSFAS in the first place appointed? And why is it then necessary to override that initial decision to appoint people? Is it because that of recent thoughts that those that have been appointed by previous ministers have been incompetent or in neglect of duty? Because I'm under the impression that the board is in the first instance appointed by the minister, and now the minister wants also to suspend the board or to dissolve the board. If the official could just clarify that for me, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. On the first question about the funds, I think it's appreciated that I've already gave an answer to it. The last part of it, to move to free tertiary education, I don't think that is being answered up to now, and maybe I can just try to assist the honourable member. The intention is not to do free education. Obviously, there is a large portion of the load that's being done with the university if a student is successful, but a 40% of the loan is still payable, and it is payable only if that student got to work, is fully employed. So it kicks into effect only at the time of employment. So there's no change to that position, and it is not making it free. And the sustainability of the fund, as I've indicated, tried to indicate it, is that even though we've had an obligation on the employers, because of the fact that they're not a party to it, don't appreciate the extent of the obligation. It was not communicated, and it was never complied with. That provision was never complied with by the NSFAS. And it came out of a ministerial report which highlights the fact that the board actually were in total breach of it, and when they were confronted, they produced the legal opinion. It was not the legal opinion of the department. It was a legal opinion that they obtained in order to deal with their statutory responsibilities. And, Chair, obviously, that ministerial report is available, and it was referred to the legal opinion, that is also the legal opinion which has been obtained by the NSFAS. The issue of the cost of the administrator, and that it is coming from the budget. Chair, the question, as I understood it, is that isn't there another budget that can also be identified? Yeah, Chair, there is obviously the budget of the department. It is a possibility. Chair, the reasoning behind it is a factor which we've used, or which the education department used also with the administrative costs in higher education institutions, where the budget provides for the running of that institution, public money which provides for the effective running of it. When you replace the board or the management by an administrator for a temporary period of time, that to build capacity or to take over the function, it is part of the administrative cost, and it is dealt with within that structure. And that was the reason why it is provided in the language that is currently there. Chair, the issue of who appoint the board, I think the honourable member already indicated
indicated that it's the minister who appoints the board. There's no work out that the minister must comply with the principle, the criteria as provided for in the legislation in order to deal with it. But Chair, it's not for me to indicate if other ministers failed in this process, and I can't express opinion on that. All I can indicate is that reality shows that the statutory responsibility that on a board is not always complied with. And there is a need to ensure that public money are dealt with in an efficient and proper manner, and where a fair opportunity is given to the board to rectify through directives, through a process to deal with the problem themselves. That failure to do that, somewhere along the line, the responsibility must then kick in to say, Minister, you must perform and make sure that there is effective governance and management of that institution in order to ensure delivery. And that is what is envisaged here. It's not for the minister to get up one day and to decide now he's going to replace the board. There is strict requirements. There is proper processes that must be dealt with. There is a soft approach of the directives, making sure that the problems is addressed by that board itself. A failure to that, then it moves over. And also, the word the dissolution of the board is where there is 75% of any board resigned is a dysfunctional board. There must be actions to replace it. If it's less than 75% and an independent person, an assessor, is making that, one must take it seriously. The minister doesn't need to follow that advice. That is provide a objective principle within which it can justify such action in the best interest of higher education and the MSFAS in particular. And lastly, it is to provide a structure where the minister is not coming in and performing the function itself, but to involve an assessor, an administrator, supported by very knowledgeable experts in the field to carry that responsibility within a short period of time. 2 years only. It can be extended for another 6 months in exceptional circumstances. But in order to just bring to address the problem, bring the institution back to the required standards and to deal with it, it's not the ministry that's going to perform it. Thank you, Chair.
I'm particularly interested in you've referred to the period of 2 years. Does that apply to an administrator for universities? But what about the NSFAS administrator? If the minister decides to appoint an administrator for NSFAS, what period more or less, and what is the cost going to be then?
Chair, the period is also not more than 2 years. It's exactly the same approach in Section 17, Capital C, that is provided for in the vote. But it's 2 years, and the cost is, we foresee, would be fairly similar to what you can expect as an administrator in our education institution.
But you are referring actually to a team of people.
Sorry, Chair, through you, it is also a situation with our education institution where the language use is basically the same. If an administrator is replacing a whole board with a lot of disciplines, with a lot of special knowledge that's required, financial management, even legal expertise, and it is for that reason that specific expertise are made available to this individual in order to perform that function in an effective way. And Chair, the whole approach is to deal with it through an individual that's accountable for that period of time, guided and supported by these experts. And it is not experts that just been appointed, but it's appointed within the need identified within that intervention.
Just the last one that I want to ask you, it relates to further education and training. Where does Umalusi belong to? Does it belong to basic education or higher education and training? I know that previously they were reporting to the Minister of Education. Now, in terms of whatever processes that have been undertaken or that must be undertaken, there are functions there belonging to further education and training and adult education and training, which effectively would move to higher education and training. Now, how does Umalusi feature in this process?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. This is one of the gray areas in the system. The legal position is in terms of Proclamation number 44 of the 4th of July, 1st of July 2009. It provided that the Genfetwa Act, which is the one under which our Malusi operates, the General and Further Education Quality Assurance Act, that act is assigned as a whole to the Minister of Basic Education that certain provisions, and which is quite an extensive part of it, on when it comes to the functioning of that institution, not the administration, has also been assigned to the minister or transferred to the minister insofar as it relates to the colleges and FET colleges and their centers. But what is important is that this is an area which we hope we will get more guidance through the white paper or the green paper processes as to how this unfortunate legal position is dealt with, because it is not the best example to have two pieces of legislation which provide authority to two different ministers to act, and where the functions are actually dependent on the administrative control which is actually resting with one of the ministers. It is not the best scenario, but that's the current legal position, and the outcome of that has not been determined yet, and that's why it is not addressed in this amendment bill at all.
Can I take it that we have Ombonyan want to say something?
As your director chair, I'll ask clarity seeking questions only. On clause 5, that is on the Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill, dissolution of board, it says the minister may dissolve the NSFAS board if that one, the conduct of the board members necessitates such action. Is there, perhaps I'm missing something, is there anywhere where stipulated how members of the board must conduct themselves or the conditions, because otherwise it could be an arbitrary decision by the minister to determine that such conduct is not in line with what the board member of the NSFAS must behave. The second one is on clause 17C under the remuneration, the remuneration and allowances. It says the minister, with approval of the Minister of Finance, may determine the remuneration allowances. That may, I know, to us non-legal minds, its use of may not carry the necessary meaning. Does it mean there are instances where the minister may not pay the allowances to this person. If you say he may determine, what does it mean?
Yeah, to start with the last question first, the word may is an option. It is a discretion that it is a discretion which must be exercised within reason, and there must be the reason must be justified within the legislative framework. And Chair, it might be that the minister appoints the public servant as an administrator. Then he may need to pay remuneration. It might be that the minister appoints the public servant as the expertise to assist the administrator. Then there's no need. The fact that it is the minister determination in the consultation with the minister on climate, because it's already part of the PSMA, there's already approved structures of payment in terms of categories of statutory organizations, which is a scale that's been approved by the Minister of Finance and which is used for administrators of the higher education institutions. And it's the same approach that's followed through in this bill, that the intention is not to force the minister to pay a remuneration where there's no need for it. Well, we're dealing with public money, and therefore it's only where it is justified to do such a payment. If you take a person who must perform a work function, and that person do not have another income, it is reasonable to compensate for that. In terms of the first question on the dissolution, where it is the issue is referring to the conduct, the Act does not prescribe that there is a code of conduct, but once again it is, if the minister wants to enforce that provision, the minister must provide either a code of conduct or provide with the appointment specific conditions of that is expected from members and which will be used in order to measure the conduct against. Chair, it is an approach which is used in the South African Broadcast Corporation Act. It's the same language that's used in that legislation, and it was also one of the guiding principles in drafting this specific clause, was to look at other legislation of similar nature, to look at the wording, to look at the approach, and to see how a minister can deal with this intervention and to give effect to his or her accountability within the functional area of higher education and training, but also provide a situation which is fair, reasonable, and transparent, which is required with the statutory organization.
Any follow-up? The last one, sir. It's clause 17A, which reads thus, notwithstanding any other provisions of the Act, the minister may, after consultation, what difference would it have made if, instead of using after, I used in consultation? Any difference?
I'm sure we'll deal with those aspects.
we've got a formidable team of legal experts for such interpretative elements. I think they know better in that area, the difference between in consultation with and after consultation with and so on. But that is fine. Maybe let me take the last hand from
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a short question. Have any risk assessments been done regarding these changes to this legislation? Thank you.
These are both questions. My attempt was not an answer. It was just to persuade Mponjani to stop that and then it will proceed to the deeper level at a later stage.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, Chair, first of all, there is a difference. In consultation means there must be an agreement of the consultation. They have consultation, but the decision maker can deviate from the opinion of the other party with whom the consultation has been conducted. Chair, the aspect of a risk assessment, I'm not sure on, is it, I presume it is on the issues referred to in the NSFOS. The NSFOS Act, these are amendments that actually came out of the ministerial report, which identified this as one of the areas.
Chair, may I just ask, initially this was given to us as, I think you used the word, not a potpourri, but a combined amended legislation. Was that subject to a risk assessment? For example, I can just imagine that transferring a few thousand employees onto the payroll of government may entail certain risks. Have that been considered? Have any formal studies been done in that regard? Thank you.
Referring to financial implications of the bill.
I presume when this is now referring to the amendments of the Further Education and Training Colleges amendment. Chair, the assessment is based 2006 amendment and the consequences to it and how it's been delivered. Obviously, lessons have been learned out of that, and also many of the post and the person identify with in terms of this legislation are still under the personnel system, which already provide the structure to deal with it. And the cost implication to the system is therefore not major. The cost implication as to the cost of employment is already paid for, and in terms of the norms and standards, and therefore it's already been calculated. Thank you, Chair.
At this stage, let me thank the presenter for the briefing that we received, and also the members for their thoughtful contributions. In the next few weeks, there will be public participation in this process, and the department will all throughout that period be available to make necessary clarifications, and we will take into consideration all these contributions that are going to emerge. Then the final product will be shaped by that process. So the department have done done their part. Now the ball is in the hands of the legislators to interact with the two bills and engage with members of society as to how they see these two bills, and thereafter we'll exercise our legislative function. I should thank you for having come and indicate to you that the office will interact with you as to the dates on which you'll be expected to come when we'll be having public consultations. Thank you, the meeting.